Hey, welcome to the show. I'm here today with Yevgeny Shajnev. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, that was absolutely right, and so glad to be here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The pleasure is all mine. So, Yevgeny, you are originally from Russia. You were a web developer there. You studied there. You did your PhD there. Then you moved to London, where you got your MSc in advanced computing. Professionally, you were an MD, you were a co-founder in a couple of different companies, and one that got merged into Forward Labs, which, you know, that's a huge deal. That's an amazing company. If you're in the tech space, you probably know them. If you're in the VC or investment space, you definitely know them. And then after that, this is where I come in, you formed a boot camp called Makers Academy in London, and that was one of the first, is that right?
That was the first bootcamp in Europe. And just for the accuracy, I didn't finish my PhD in Russia. I dropped out. But just for the sake of the record. But otherwise, yes, largely correct. Makers, yes, was the first bootcamp in Europe in 2013.
So where does the idea for Makers come about? And what's the motivation for that? And how revolutionary is it at the time?
At the time, it did sound a bit crazy. The idea was actually pretty simple. My co-founder Rob and I, we saw that there are not enough developers on the market. Still the same problem that we have today. And it's really difficult to become a developer. Usually people go to university and spend years getting a computer science degree like I did. But this is not nearly efficient and doesn't really answer the need of the market. So the starting point for Rob and I was to ask ourselves, can we train complete beginners to be employable software developers 10 times faster and 10 times cheaper than a university? And this is what we set out to do by training complete beginners to become software developers in just 12 weeks. Or it was 10. It was 10 at the beginning, then we switched to 12. A lot of people told us that we were crazy at the time. Not just that we were crazy. Some people told us that it's plain fraudulent, that you just can't take a complete beginner and get them to an employable level and if they in just 3 months. And if this is what we're promising to people, then we're basically want to run away with their money. It turned out that it's actually possible if we approach training and or education in a different way from how computer science and software development is usually taught.
What made you so special? Like your the vision that you had at the time that made this successful?
Well, first of all, I'm absolutely not special. I think like all startups, it starts with an impossible question, a bit of luck and a lot of hard work. We really wanted to answer the question. We really tried to figure out what is at the core of what makes a person employable as a software developer, and then strip away all the rest. My personal experience of getting two computer science degrees was that I learned a lot of useful stuff, but a lot of that was not actually applicable in my job as a software developer. It was focused to a significant degree on computer science concepts, and they are interesting and useful, and there is nothing wrong with it, except that not every job requires them. And so we started with the end question of what makes a software developer employable, and then reverse engineer it from there, making sure that the only things which make it onto the course are directly related to employability. And by the way, employability was also core to what we do at Makers from day one, because my own challenge with my university was that I had a really good course. I learned a lot. Then we had an amazing graduation ceremony at the Royal Albert Hall that my parents loved. Great photos. And then that was it. Getting a job was my own problem. If there was a career advice team at the university, I don't think anyone on my course was actually using it or even aware of it. And to me, it was surprising because people get education not just for the fun of it, in most cases, but in order to be employable in order to get some real world skills. And so for us at Makers, from day one, we focused on how do we get people into jobs. As we always tell our students, our work doesn't stop until you sign a contract.
Mm. And you were very, very good at getting people into jobs, weren't you? I mean, obviously not everyone had an amazing 10 out of 10 experience, but the vast majority of people did. And I think Makers was and is still one of the most highly rated boot camps for getting people into the careers that they want. So how do you build something like that? And what changes have been made over time to ensure that success?
One really important element is staying in touch with the employers. Not focusing on the standard and what we think we are teaching, but going to employers all the time and figuring out what they want today, what the market wants today, and then updating the course in response. One of the reasons we really resisted any kind of standardization of our course in our early years is because we wanted to stay really responsive to the needs of the students. So if someone, one of the people we trained went to an interview, didn't get a job, we would talk to them and try to figure out, okay, what didn't work? Was it the person, our training, our selection process, any specific aspect of the curriculum, interview readiness? What is the element? And then we'd go back and say, okay, we need to adjust this. And if you do it continuously with almost 2,000 people by now, then it translates into lots of tiny adjustments to the course, which help people to stay employable.
And, you know, unfortunately, boot camps globally have a slightly bad reputation now, I think because they fail at the career's end. You know, you've done really, really well in that part of the life cycle. Do you have any advice for people who are maybe struggling post-boot camp?
It's genuinely difficult to give generic advice that would help everyone, because the reasons why someone might be struggling, having been trained by different coding boot camps, the reasons might be so different. For some people, it may be mindset, for others, technical skills. And for someone else, it may have nothing to do with them, but everything to do with the state of the market right now and in the last year. Right now, the market is getting better, but I recently spent a lot of time talking to someone who was looking for her first developer job in the last 6 months. And that's been genuinely difficult because we are in a pandemic. Companies are changing how they are hiring, and the junior end of the market is suffering more than let's say the senior end of the market. So there are lots of moving parts here, and it really depends on the individual situation. However, in any case, regardless of the state of the market and what's happening in the world globally, a really helpful question to start is what's happening right now, what are my main challenges, and what I can do about it? Because we only control ourselves, our own actions, our own reactions, and we can't really influence the world around us.
So I've been hearing whispers about this, about the state of the junior hiring market. Is it really that bad right now? And do you think after the pandemic, it's going to recover?
It's significantly better than it was half a year ago or even a year ago. When we went into the lockdown, junior hiring activity almost stopped. I'd say that April, May, and June were probably three most difficult months. And then it started to pick up. First, because the first lockdown was over and everyone thought, okay, this is coming to an end. But then, even as we realized that the second wave is coming, the tech sector adjusted to the new reality. And so today we are in a far, far better position than a year ago. And I'm quite optimistic that we'll get to pre-pandemic levels in the very near future, if not already.
So I'd like to move on from the student side of Makers to your role as a founder. You know, Makers, I guess, for people who haven't been there, you know, it'd be hard to sort of explain it, but it was just this wonderful buzzing atmosphere of like, you know, sheer brilliance and like, you know, endless optimism and energy. It was also like from the business side of it, it seemed to be really experimental and really flat and, you know, seemed to be applying a lot of sort of modern theories on how a business should be run, how people should be taught.
Funny enough, a lot of it was driven by our own inexperience as a management team. We were just experimenting and trying different things by seeing what could work. But ultimately, we were trying to build a company that we would like to work at as employees and not only founders. So we instinctively tried to do our best to treat everyone well, to minimize the hierarchy and the power distance between individuals, to empower the team to the highest possible extent, and sometimes we did crazy things like inviting the team to set their own salaries, mm-hmm. Which we can talk about later. In a nutshell, we just weren't afraid to experiment. We came to the business with the attitude of not we know how to do things or we've got a textbook with answers, but we came with an attitude of we've got no idea. Let's try lots of things. Let's learn. Let's see what's going to work. Let's stop doing what's not working and let's keep doing what is working. So there was a lot of experimentation, change, and just this spirit of learning and moving forward.
And I guess you put in a lot of effort in hiring the right people who shared the same sort of attitude and ethos. And you could really tell.
Yes, and this importantly also influenced our students and how we train our students. You can't really have a different culture between the staff and the students, especially if everyone is in the same office. If we wanted to make our students really entrepreneurial, open to change, comfortable with the uncertainty, willing to take risks and learn from them, we had to lead by example as a team. There is no other way. So to a significant extent, the atmosphere that you described on campus that students experienced was to a degree a reflection of just how we ran the company, and I think it was unavoidable.
Moving on to diversity and inclusion, this is, you know, a massive topic for the industry as a whole.
And the world.
And the world, yeah, and it's a big problem, right? That forms such a big part of the whole makers sort of makeup. You know, you were very diverse and inclusive, not only in the staff, but in the students and then helping those students get jobs. So at what point does diversity and inclusion, that concept, come into your consciousness, and then how does it develop from there?
We never really thought about it as diversity and inclusion from the beginning. We thought about it as common sense. From the very beginning, it was obvious that there are not enough women in the tech industry. So I think our first or maybe second, no, I think our first cohort, we started offering discount for female applicants to incentivize them to join the course. But we didn't see it as a D&I effort. Diversity and inclusion only came into our vocabulary probably 2 or 3 years later when we started to look at, okay, how do we run the business in principle, and they started to systematize some of our efforts. But I think from the beginning, we just tried to see everyone as human and not really have any policy about it. It was just how we did business.
Right. And I suppose hiring partners responded very well to that as well, because it's so hard for them to hire, you know, let's say, for example, non-white or Asian men into tech.
Yep. It's a big problem. And we didn't really think that it would be our business advantage at first. At first, we were just focused on training software developers and making sure they're really good. But then eventually we realized that based on the feedback from our hiring partners, that we are a source of not only good software developers, but of diverse software developers, and the industry really values it. And that was probably the moment, maybe a couple of years in, that we started to pay deliberate attention to it.
So we've talked about a couple of the sort of really experimental things that you tried out and that worked quite well. You mentioned one which didn't work so well, perhaps, which was setting your own salary.
Well, we can have the whole episode on or two on this. Well, it was real in the sense that it worked for 4 years. Roughly 2015 to 2019, the team was setting their own salary, so it worked for dozens of people across several years. The good news is that it worked. The bad news is that it did not work well. So we realized that while the intention behind it was just to give that as much decision-making power to the team as possible and to trust them to make best decisions, decentralizing this process was a recipe for creating salary disparities across every single dimension. It was a recipe for making sure that women are paid differently from men, that people in the same position are paid differently even though they're doing the same job. And without a central mechanism to adjust for it, we ended up in a situation where there were impossible to defend discrepancies in salaries. And on top of this, it was difficult for the team. At the end of the day, everyone just wants to be paid well and fairly for their efforts. The process of setting the salary yourself involves asking the team to do the work that their manager and HR are supposed to be doing. That is really go to the market, do a significant part of their own or the groundwork for their own performance review, figure out how what they are doing contributes to the company as a whole. And all of this is a lot of work. At the end, we realized that it was a really good experiment, and we learned a lot. But we need to have something more traditional in place.
And when you say that there was this gender disparity, was it, I'm making an assumption here, but was it that men were being more confident about I deserve 100K, and women were being more conservative and saying I deserve 60K?
Well, the gap. You're right about the fact that men were paid more than women, or were paying themselves more than women. But the gap was not that huge. So it wasn't like 40%. It was more like a few percentage points. But still, it was there.
Moving on to scaling, like I know this was a big part of what you wanted to achieve at Makers, and I know you did achieve a lot of it. What sort of things did you try, and what did you discover in that process?
There are so many elements and aspects to scaling, from from really nailing your business model and building the right team, and also growing as a leader, as a CEO. That I think I can honestly say that I learned a lot about each of those aspects, mostly by making mistakes. But maybe one of the most interesting and hard-won lessons was that before trying to scale, it's really important to make sure the foundations are in place, that the business model is sound, that the unit economics are sound, that all the processes across the company work well. Because when you try to scale, essentially you try to amplify whatever is already happening, and you amplify the bad stuff together with the good stuff. Mm-hmm. If you try to scale before you fix some of the important challenges at the beginning, and every company, every startup has them, it will probably create more problems than it will solve.
You've been a co-founder a few times over. You were one of the founders at Makers. Did you have an exit strategy going into this?
Well, there is a story here. When we first started the business, we thought it would be, our exit strategy was really short. We thought we'd build something over maybe 2 or 3 years and then sell it. And this is, of course, was a reflection of our inexperience at the time. The truth is, if a company is going to work, it's probably going to take a decade to build it and maybe more. There is a reason why venture capital funds usually operate on a 10-year time scale. It takes a lot of time to get something to an exit. So in terms of an exit, it's been on our mind from day one, because we are a venture-backed business and eventually we'll need to solve it.
I was reading some of the interviews you've done, you said that you wish you had listened to more experienced people at times. I'm really curious about this one. Are there any examples that you were referencing?
Not any one specific, but I wish I found a chair of the board of directors sooner. I wish I started working with an executive coach sooner. I wish I just leveraged more people earlier. When I think about the first few years at Makers, I was spending, well, the entire team was working really, really hard, and we were spending a lot of time trying to build the business, which is, of course, right. But looking back, I wish we spent slightly more time getting out of the business and getting advice from other founders, advisors, other investors, the other non-executive directors, coaches, chair. Just building this network is can be incredibly helpful, and I only learned how to do it maybe a few years in. I wish I had this experience a few years earlier. So in practice today, whenever I'm doing something, yes, of course, I'm working hard and trying to rely on myself. But a question which is always in my mind is, whatever I'm trying to do, who does it well? Can I get in touch with them? Can I learn from them? Can I read a book? What have I learned today? What have I learned last week? How is it going to change what I'm doing next week? Hard work is important, but the learning process is not going to happen on its own. Learning process is not a side effect. It needs to be deliberate. This is something which I only learned over the years.
Another thing you've talked about is changing beliefs and assumptions about ourselves and others. This is something I think you're really quite passionate about. How can you help me change and grow in this direction?
Well, as an executive coach, I can ask you some questions and indulge my curiosity.
Sure.
So the process of changing our assumptions begins with identifying those assumptions first. It's all about being present in the moment and trying to stay curious about what's happening right now. And I'm not talking about meditation. This is also super interesting, and this is another topic. I'm also talking on a very mundane level about what's happening in any given moment, in any given meeting, in any given conversation. How am I showing up? What assumptions am I making about the other person, about myself? What hopes or fears do I have about the future? How it influences what I'm doing right now? Is it serving me? Is it not serving me? One practice which I find incredibly helpful is doing regular journaling, looking forward and looking back. So I try to start every day by planning the day and doing a little bit of journaling and a little bit of reflection. Okay, what do I expect? What am I from today? What am I looking forward to? What what's on the agenda today? And then at the end of the day, set aside maybe for 20 minutes to wrap up and to think, okay, what have I learned today? What happened? What was surprising? What was good? And then do the same on larger cycles, on a weekly basis, beginning of the week, end of the week, monthly basis. What do I need to do this month? What happened this month? The same for a quarter, the same for the year. And I find this is one of the key components for my learning process, just having a structure for constant reflection on what's happening right now, what's happening, what's been happening recently, and trying to also to stay present to what's happening in the moment.
Okay, that's good advice. I'm going to try and take some of that.
If you'd like to talk more about it, let me know anytime.
I would love to, but I really feel like your powers would be totally wasted on me. You mentioned executive coaching, and you also mentioned that, you know, you've exited yourself from Makers. You're now actually an executive coach for other CEOs. Is that right?
Yes, CEOs and startup leaders in general. I help people like me who are building companies and growing personally and professionally and struggling with the same questions that I faced when I was running Makers.
So how do you get into something like this? So what motivates you to do this, other than obviously you've got many, many years of experience that are relevant to it?
What motivated me was my experience of working with my own executive coaches over the years. I worked with four different coaches when I was a CEO of Makers, and I learned a lot from all of them. My experience as a founder is not actually that relevant, because a coach is not an advisor. I'm not here to tell my clients what to do or tell them what worked for me in the past. My experience is my experience, but the way it's helpful and relevant is that it really helps me to understand what my clients are going through. When they tell me what it's like to be fundraising or face a decision about letting someone go or think about restructuring the company or communication challenges in their senior management team, I know what they're going through because I've been there. I know what it's like to look at two bad choices and think, okay, which one is the right one, or what's another angle on the situation. So it helps me to connect to other people.
And so, on some level, is being a good executive coach about just being a really good set of ears, someone you can trust to listen to?
Listening is one of the foundational skills for any executive coach. Yes. Another is being very attentive and present. Much of what I do is just paying attention to what's happening in the moment with a client. Not just what they are saying, that's half of it, but another half of what they are not saying, what their body language is saying, what their facial expression is saying, what their tone of voice might indicate. And this guides my curiosity and intuition. One of the things which I love the most about executive coaching is that you can't really have a plan for an executive coaching session. It's not the training or some other kind of situation when you prepare an agenda and you know that, okay, we've got 90 minutes and we'll go through these points. It's always an improvisation. It's like dancing together. But not in a way which is scripted, but in a way which is, where two people improvise and stay attentive to each other and go forward together. And this is a very fulfilling, rewarding, and sometimes challenging process. In a nutshell, it's about helping people to maximize their potential. One way to see executive coaching is to think about awareness and responsibility. A big part of my job is to help the client to be more aware of what's happening in the moment for them. And once they are aware of what's happening, I help them to take responsibility to do something about it. It's their choice, it's their responsibility, but I can help them to figure out what the next step should be. As my first coach used to say, this being so, so what? This being so means here is the situation, no judgment, just what's happening right now. So what means what are we going to do about it? Acceptance plus a responsibility of choosing the next step.
Maybe one day you'll be my executive coach when I'm important enough.
You are already important enough. Let's talk about it after the show.
Okay, great. I'm curious because you mentioned journaling. Did you do your journal this morning?
No, not yet.
Not yet?
Yep, my intention for later in the day. I'm in a different time zone, Sanjay.
Oh yeah, sorry. I'm really sorry. All right. I'm curious what you're going to say about this.
I'll laugh about it and probably share some of my reflections and emotions.
So what's next for you? Is this something you're going to pursue for a while? Have you got another startup crazy idea on your brain?
Nope, I'm very much fully focused on executive coaching. I've been retraining as an executive coach ever since I left Makers last September. And I'm very much enjoying working with my clients. It's a very different kind of work, but it's so fulfilling and interesting and enjoyable. That in a sense, it came around full circle. I spent 8 years helping other people to change jobs, and then I left Makers in order to change my own job, and now do something else. So this is not to say that I will never, ever, ever start another company. Maybe I will, but no, there are no immediate plans. I'm very much focused on helping others at the moment. Let's talk about executive coaching. Off the record.
Okay, but look, before I let you go,
yeah,
you know, I need a joke of the show from you.
Okay, so I'm very, very bad at telling jokes, so this one is going to be like super short one. So my boss told me to have a good day, so I went home.
Great. Thank you, Evgeny. That's a wonderful joke.
Thank you, Sanjay.
Okay,
have a nice day.
You too. Have a wonderful day. Thank you again so much. I really, really appreciate your time.